Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. It's Monday, so this is an archive show. First published as a newspaper column sometime in the last 10 years. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on April 21st of 2024, under the headline Sammy Davis Jr. Once Called Portland Home. It's a rewritten and thoroughly re-researched version of a much shorter article published in November of 2011. Here we go. Back before World War II, when racism was still a mainstream attitude with little or no social stigma attached, Portland was not a very friendly town for black people. It's not that way anymore, of course. There's still racism, but the toxic race hierarchicalism that winked at lynchings and enabled the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, well, that, thankfully, is a distant and uncomfortable memory today. And one has to wonder how much of that transformation, not just in Portland but around the nation, can be attributed to the influence of one man, a man still today widely known as the world's greatest entertainer, Sammy Davis Jr. Davis came to Portland with his dance group, the Will Maston Trio, composed of Davis, his father, and his father's best friend, Will Maston, just after the Second World War. For a little while, he was a regular in P-Town's clubs and vaudeville theaters. In fact, he was in Portland performing a regular run at Amato's Supper Club with the trio when he got the telegram that changed his life forever. "Open Capitol Theater, New York, next month," it read. "Frank Sinatra Show, 3 weeks, $1,250 per. Details follow." It was signed by Harry Rogers. Rogers was Frank Sinatra's agent. After getting that telegram, the three of them had to sit down for a bit. "We passed that telegram back and forth like three drunks working out of the same bottle," Davis wrote in his memoirs many years later. They knew what it meant. It meant that instead of going down slowly with the sinking ship that was the local vaudeville theater industry, they were about to go nationwide. Sammy Davis Jr. was born into show business. He first came on the scene on December 8, 1925 in Harlem. But he first made the scene 3 years later as a tiny toddler playing a bit part in a vaudeville review show called Struttin' Hannah from Savannah as part of the vaudeville troupe that his parents were part of. Both of Sammy's parents, Sammy and Elvira Sanchez Davis, were respected vaudevillians. Elvira was a chorus singer, and Sammy Sr. was already a storied song and dance man. Both lived in New York and were part of a vaudeville troupe led by performer impresario Will Maston. At nearly the same time, Sammy Sr. and Elvira's marriage broke down, and she quit the Maston troupe and joined with a competitor. With fewer childcare options, Sammy Sr. started bringing the boy onto the stage more and more. And little Sammy loved it. If you grab a dictionary and look up the word natural, as in the kid is a natural, a picture of young Sammy Davis Jr. will be right there on the page. Well, no, it won't, but it should be. As little Sammy got older, he soon left bit parts behind, and Maston and the two Sammies formed a song and dance group, calling themselves the Will Maston Trio. Not long after that, they changed the name to the Will Maston Trio featuring Sammy Davis Jr. The kid was that good. But of course, you knew that. For the elder Sammy Davis, what had started as an alternative to finding a babysitter soon evolved into battles with truant agents trying to force the boy to stop performing and attend grade school. The legend is that the trio's response was to move on to the next town on the vaudeville circuit that they were working and introduce the 8-year-old Sammy Jr. as a 16-year-old midget. The story seems hard to buy with a straight face, but maybe the truant agent was willing to play along. Or maybe he was one of those all-black-people-look-the-same-to-me types and really couldn't tell the difference. Either way, Sammy was allowed to be essentially homeschooled. Possibly his most influential teacher was the tap dancing legend known as Bojangles Robinson. Now, this is the original Bojangles, not the street performer that Jerry Jeff Walker met in the drunk tank in New Orleans and wrote a song about. Later in his career, Sammy would make Walker's Mr. Bojangles his signature song, though. When he sang it, you know he wasn't thinking about the guy in New Orleans. He was thinking about the real Bojangles Robinson. Sammy met the great Bojangles when he was 9, and Bojangles was about 44. He gave young Sammy the piece of advice that he would literally build his whole career on. Always make it look easy. Never let the audience even catch a glimpse of how physically demanding the act is. In fact, the more obviously strenuous the act, the more important this illusion of effortlessness becomes. If you're familiar with Sammy's work at all, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Of course, Sammy would not have had the chance to meet Bojangles and learn from him if he'd been parked in some third-grade classroom somewhere in Tulsa or Atlanta, but Sammy's lack of public school experience would have some rough consequences later in his life, not because of lack of knowledge, but because of lack of experience with racism in mainstream American society in the 1930s and 40s. Because Will and Sammy Sr. largely protected little Sammy from any experience of 1930s-style racism. And the vaudeville scene didn't really show him any either. Like a lot of high-performance professions, vaudeville was a world in which ability was king. And from infancy, Sammy Sr. and Uncle Will Maston had shielded him from even what relatively little racism there was in vaudeville. "That man was just jealous because we're in show business and he's going to be pushing beans all his damn life," Sammy Sr. told his young son on one occasion after a drugstore lunch counter clerk dropped the N-bomb on the three entertainers and ordered them to sit at the colored end of the counter. The young black fellow on the vaudeville circuit would certainly see some racism. Segregated facilities, rude hotel clerks, disrespectful white people at venues, and would quickly figure out that discrimination was a thing. But to learn about the dangers of knockdown, drag-out, toxic racist cruelty, one had to go outside that world a bit, to a segregated public school where other less sheltered kids would tell you about it, or into the United States Army, where you could experience it firsthand. The Army was a horrible shock to young Sammy Davis, who was drafted when he turned 18 in 1943. Throughout his life, Sammy had learned to deploy his talents. By now, he was a gifted performer who could tap dance, sing, do celebrity impressions, and deploy his magnificently expressive face to great comedic effect, to charm people and make them like him. This did not work in the Army. Fellow draftees and drill sergeants and officers in the Army came from all over the country, including parts of it where segregation and racial roles were so locked down that even meeting a white person's eyes and smiling at him, or worse, her, was evidence of a kind of insubordination punishable with attempted murder. And attempted murder, the kind where the person administering a beating clearly doesn't care if it's fatal or not, became a part of Sammy's life for the first time in the Army. His father's pocket watch was smashed, and so, several times, was Sammy's nose. It ended up permanently flattened. Eventually, the Army figured out that Sammy would be more valuable as an entertainer than as a combat soldier, and after that, he got better protection. He still never got promoted, though, and he mustered out of the Army at the end of the war holding the same rank he had coming in, private. It was all somewhat ironic. It was the Army that taught a whole generation of white American men to question their racist views, which they found hard to square with what they learned about the quality and character of black soldiers who fought beside them and occasionally saved their lives in combat. But for young Sammy, perhaps because the people he encountered weren't real combat veterans, the experience was much different. It was a harsh way to lose one's innocence, and it left an unmistakable bitterness that took a long time to fade. But it left something else, too. There's an old saying that the fire that burns the straw also purifies the gold. Sammy left the Army more determined than ever to use his talents to change the world in whatever way he could. But there was no denying that he was profoundly demoralized. You can't mistake the bleakness in his prose when he writes his memoirs about that time in his life, where once he'd been a proud showbiz man, feeling like his life was glamorous and going places. Now he felt the rut he was in. And by now, yeah, it was definitely a rut. The fortunes of the Will Maston trio were fading like the vaudeville era they were part of, fading to a starvation diet of bad-paying shows in different towns, occasional grueling strings of one-night stands, to the dreaded day when they'd have to give it up and start pushing beans themselves. Some of Sammy's old friends had made it big, though. Really big. One of those people was Frank Sinatra. The Will Mastin Trio had performed with him in 1941, when Sammy was just 15 and Old Blue Eyes was 26, and the boy had struck up a strong friendship with the legendary chairman of the board. Back then, Sinatra had been just another promising young singer. But now, in the wake of the war, his star was rising like a rocket. It was good to have successful friends, but that didn't pay the bills. Sammy's group played on. Los Angeles, Chicago, Boston, Portland. The Will Mastin Trio was in Portland for 2 years, playing regularly in the Clover Room nightclub, among other local hotspots. Sammy and his team were one of Stumptown's hottest draws, but still, it wasn't exactly a prestige gig. Although it had a sizzling jazz scene at the time, Portland was not an A-list town, and it was on its way to almost nowhere. Portland has to have been one of the lowest points for the trio. It's certainly among the least important cities they performed in. But Sammy was a showman. He loved to be loved, and there's no question but that Portland loved him. Plus, there may have been some racism in Portland, but at least it wasn't a back-of-the-bus boy kind of town. He doesn't talk about this in his memoirs, but it's at least possible that Sammy was planning on sticking around a while, settling for being a big fish in a little pond. And that's where he was when that fateful telegram arrived from Frank Sinatra. Significantly, Sammy stuck around Portland for several years after his big break, basking in the glow of its audiences and hanging out with its showbiz people as his career started lifting off. Stuck around well after his roster of options had expanded to include much more prestigious cities. After 1947, the Will Mastin Trio was on its way, with a little help from an old friend. Life for the three of them would never be the same, and for fans of Frank Sinatra's Rat Pack, it would be remembered as the dawn of a golden age. Key sources in this story included works by Sammy Davis Jr., of course, Phil Stanford, independent fan site sammydavisjr.info, and most of all, a book by Robert Dicha called Jumptown, which if you are not familiar with it, you should fare forth on the instant and get a copy from the library and check it out. Great book. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I sure hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do, or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. If you like Offbeat Oregon History, the podcast, you should totally check out my friend Marcus Axford's podcast, Welcome to Oregon. He drops an episode, I think, every 2 weeks, and they're half an hour long, and they're just really fun, low-key kind of explorations. They overlap topics quite a bit with me, but we do slightly different things, and it works out pretty well, so check them out if you haven't, if you've got any room on your podcasting dance card. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. There is more information about them at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes come out once per weekday, usually around 6 a.m., so it won't be long before the next episode is on your device and ready for you to queue up and enjoy. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.